Welcome to World Affairs, the weekly broadcast of the World Affairs Council. I'm Jane Wales, CEO. This week's episode focuses on North Korea, the danger posed by its nuclear program, and its ongoing human rights abuses. In this hour, we'll hear from Daniel Snyder. He's Associate Director for Research at Stanford University's Asia-Pacific Research Center. We'll also hear from Philip Yuen. He's Executive Director at the Plowshares Fund. This event was recorded in San Francisco before a World Affairs audience, and the broadcast is made possible by the generous support of Chevron. And now to our moderator, Neil Jock. He's research scholar at the Institute for International Studies at University of California, Berkeley.
Good evening to all of you, and thank you all for attending this evening. I'm Neil Jock. It's my pleasure to be here with old friends and everyone assembled. Tonight's program is entitled North Korea on the Verge. We have two superb analysts of Korean affairs with a lot of history in the region, both in journalism and in the government. Dan Snyder is the associate director now at the for research at Stanford University's Walter Shorenstein Asia-Pacific Research Center. His research focuses on current U.S. foreign and national security policy in Asia, and on the foreign policy of Japan and Korea. In 2010, Dan was named a National Asia Research Fellow by the Woodrow Wilson International Center for Scholars and the National Bureau for Asian Research. Prior to coming to Stanford, Snyder was a longtime foreign correspondent, and he has written extensively on national security issues and Asia. Philip Yuen is the Executive Director and Chief Operating Officer of Plowshares Fund, a foundation that funds and organizes projects that reduce and eliminate nuclear weapon threats. Prior to that position, Philip was a Pantech scholar in Korean studies at Stanford University, where he co-edited the book North Korea 2005 and Beyond. As a high-level diplomat, he also met Kim Jong-il in 2000. He was part of a working group that managed U.S. policy toward North Korea under President Clinton, and was senior advisor to the first U.S. coordinator for North Korea policy, former Secretary of Defense William J. Perry. So please join me in welcoming both Philip Yuen and Dan Snyder for a conversation about what's happening in North Korea now and what we can expect in the near future. The title is North Korea on the Verge. So is North Korea on the verge, and on the verge of what? President Trump made a comment about sending an armada to Northeast Asia. It helps us set the stage for what we're looking at. Philip has recently written an article posted on the Plowshares Fund page on North Korea hard choices. In that, and I'll quote just a bit here, he says, the U.S. is in the middle of a slow motion train wreck with North Korea over its nuclear weapons and missile program. Unless we do something about it now, a metal on metal collision could be in the offing. Philip, given President Trump's comments this morning, would you like to comment about whether we are about to have that collision?
Yeah, so at Plowshares Fund, we work to reduce and eliminate the threat of nuclear weapons, and obviously North Korea is an area and a region that we've been focusing a lot on as of late, and I think it's some amount of work that there's a lot more work, obviously, that has to be done. So we're focusing a lot of resources on that particular issue. I'm really worried right now. We have, for a number of us, Dan included, have foreseen that we are going to have a rise in tensions. We knew that there was going to be some military exercises that North Koreans absolutely hated. We also knew that the United States, because of two nuclear tests that happened last year, two very large nuclear tests that happened last year, the United States said that these military exercises were going to be more robust than ever. So you have the situation where the North Koreans said, don't do this, and then where the United States says, we are going to do this. Now think about what's happening right now. We have 1.2 million man army in the North. We have something like 700,000 South Korean troops. And we have 30,000 and probably, I think, 17,000 more that are in the Korean Peninsula right now with these military exercises, all roaming around the Korean Peninsula. Accidents happen. It may not be, I'm not worried, quite frankly, of a preemptive nuclear strike by North Korea on the United States or anywhere else. And to be honest, I'm not sure that realistically that is an option that the United States is willing to seriously consider, and we can talk about that a little bit later. What is a danger is miscalculation. What happens? What happens if one of these missiles that North Korea tests just goes in the wrong direction and hits something in the wrong place? What happens if a soldier who falls asleep or who gets startled by something shoots something across the DMZ and starts a firefight? What happens when there is an exchange of fire in the EC over fishing rights? All these things have happened to some degree in the past. And what happens then is things happen very quickly and could go out of control, in which, and into this heightened circumstance of rhetoric, you have to add Kim Jong-un, who is relatively inexperienced, very aggressive, and is unpredictable. Kind of sounds like our current president right now, okay? And there are good things and bad things about that, but those two together are incredibly volatile mix. And that's really what I'm worried about. And, you know, in terms of our longer term options, we can talk about that a little bit later, Jack, but I'll stop right there in terms of what I'm really worried about right now. Well, and we should all should be.
Thanks very much. That sets the table in somewhat worrisome ways. But in a lot of this, we see exchanges between the United States talking about North Korea and calling on China and so on. But I think it's important, before we get very far into that, to think about what's the perspective from South Korea, which itself is very concerned about both accidents and deliberate acts on the part of the United States as a longtime and important ally. So, Dan, I wonder if you have some thoughts about the domestic scene in South Korea and how that looks.
Well, I think it's extremely important, you know, to think about South Korea, and sometimes I worry that Americans and American policymakers don't do that. They see the world in terms of the dynamic between us and the North Koreans, or us and the Chinese and the North Koreans. But we have an ally there, and it's the ally that is standing right in the crosshairs if anything goes wrong. And I think one of the things, one of the signs of the sort of nervousness that Philip was referring to was that the South Korean government felt compelled this week to reassure its population that the United States was not going to carry out a preemptive attack on North Korea. No South Korean leader can contemplate the possibility of that kind of action, even though as provocative as the North Koreans can be and have been. And don't forget, this is a North Korea that three times tried to assassinate the leader of South Korea, carried out numerous acts of mass terrorism against South Korea, and yet South Koreans have never responded with a large-scale military retaliation for the simple reason that they know that the risk of escalation, which would put the entire population of Seoul, which is, you know, 30 million people in the larger metropolitan area, at risk, is just unacceptable. So, and then add to that this, which is that South Korea is going through a presidential election. They impeached their president, Park Geun-hye. It was a very unusual and stressful exercise in democracy in South Korea. And they called early elections. Elections weren't to be held usually till the end of the year. And on May 9th, there will be a presidential election. So they're in the midst of a campaign. And it's a very hard-fought and fervent campaign. So all of these issues that are going on between North Korea and the United States and China and the U.S. are all playing into the South Korean presidential election campaign. And it allows some candidates to posture that, you know, I'm the one that's going to stand up to the United States, and others who are going to say, no, I'm the one that's going to maintain a close relationship to the United States and prevent an escalation of tensions. So politics, domestic politics, is very much a part of this. So all this makes for an even more combustible mixture, if you will, than the one that Philip started out discussing.
I'd like to just extend that a little bit, if I could, and follow up on the election, given what happened in November in the United States. Of course, anyone who predicts the outcome of an election is a brave individual. So I won't ask you to predict the outcome, but if the left in South Korea, as some people think, is now sort of going to take its turn, are we going to have another round of a sunshine policy, and how might that play out?
Well, I mean, the easy prediction to make is that the some form of progressive candidate is going to come back to power in Korea after South Korea after 10 years of conservative, nearly 10 years of conservative rule, in which there was a lot of questioning of the strategy of engagement with North Korea, the so-called Sunshine Policy. So whether it's Moon Jae-in, the Democratic Party candidate, or it's Ahn Cheol-soo, the sort of more independent progressive candidate. Either way, I think we're going to get some type of return to a more engagement-focused approach to North Korea. And that's, you know, what that creates is the possibility that we're going to have a gap between what Seoul wants to do and what Washington wants to do. Now, that's not unprecedented in our relationship. We've had tensions between allies a lot. And, of course, it takes us back to, and I'm sure Philip painfully aware of this one, you know, at the end of the Clinton administration, we had a progressive government in South Korea under Kim Dae-jung, and we had the Clinton administration, and there was a fair amount of cohesion of approach towards North Korea. Then the Bush administration came into office, and we had a real divergence of approach, and for some years we had a lot of difficulty managing our alliance. And South Koreans, including of the progressive variety, are well aware of the problem of that. They want to avoid that type of thing, but we could still have a real divergence of approach. And that, I think, is going to be a big challenge in the coming months.
So, you know, one of the things to point out about this, though, is we're making assumptions about what Trump's policy is going to be, and quite frankly, we're not sure what it's going to be at this point. We've seen how, with respect to Russia, the Trump policy has gone 180 degrees from expectations to what was being said and what was being acted upon. Donald Trump in the campaign said, I want to have a hamburger with Kim Jong-un. So when I was thinking about that, well, that could actually be very good, or it could be an absolute disaster depending on how it's executed. So right now, Rex Tillerson spoke about having a new policy, strategic patience is dead. But in reality, what they have stated up to this point is pretty much more of the same. It is, from what I've been able to determine, a policy that focuses on sanctions. It's a policy that focuses on pressure, some defensive moves, and basically, I would say, outsourcing it to China. And I don't see, that failed back in the early 2000s, and it's going to fail again.
As a former high-level diplomat, Philip, can you give us some sense for how things developed in the Clinton administration? And then if we're again in a position with a more conservative American president confronting a more liberal South Korean government, and I don't want to press that too far, but if that's the case, how might that look? How might the South Koreans respond to that? And does it portend difficulties in the alliance structure?
Well, what's going to happen is that if it's a progressive government, they're going to want to show more independence from the United States. And so therefore, they will not tolerate any nationalist in South Korea. They're not going to want to be perceived as kowtowing or caving into pressure from the United States. And so when you have a difference of policy, what people in the U.S. government are going to be afraid of is that South Korea is going to get too far ahead and pull the United States farther than it's willing to do so. That, depending on the circumstances, may be a good thing, or it could not be such a good thing. It just sort of depends. But that's the dynamic that is going on. And what we had during the Clinton administration towards the latter half was essentially stepping back. Diplomacy and timing is everything. I mean, you can have all the right players, but if the timing is wrong, it's not going to work. And so at the 1998-2000 period, everything had aligned. We had the Chinese who were just basically willing to step back and let others take the lead. You had a Clinton administration that was willing to move forward. You had Kim Dae-jung, who was definitely moving forward. And the Japanese were in the right place. So all these things seemed to work. Then what happened is suddenly you had George Bush come in, who was definitely more to the right, more conservative, wanting to be more hardline. And then you had Roh Moo-hyun, who was elected, who was even farther left than Kim Dae-jung to some degree. And then there was that huge gap, and you weren't able to get anything done. And in a sense, North Korea then was able to take advantage of these gaps. And so that's what I think the outcome will be, is if there's a lack of coordination among the United States, South Korea in particular, but it also shows the lack of coordination that has existed right now between the Chinese and the United States. China on one hand, the United States, South Korea, and Japan on the other, North Korea is going to drive a truck through it and take advantage, as they've had for the last several years.
Yeah, one element of this is the Chinese relationship also to South Korea. So the progressives are a little more sympathetic to the importance of improving, maintaining good relations with China, balancing their relationship a little bit with the United States, with a good relationship with China. And, of course, the issue immediately on the table is the decision of the conservative government to deploy a missile defense system, which China strongly opposes because they believe it in some way impairs their own nuclear forces. And the progressives, depending on who you talk to, are either willing to roll back that decision or at least willing to listen to the Chinese. And that's an area where, again, you know, we always worry about South Korea being kind of pulled in two different directions.
Mm-hmm. I want to get into the China factor quite a bit, and mm-hmm. I'm sure the audience is very interested in that. But I did want to, again, just set the stage a little bit more and talk about our other important ally in the Northeast Asia, of course, which is Japan. So do you have some thoughts about how Japan is viewing this whole dynamic?
You know, this is it's a really complicated moment for the Japanese because the Abe government in Tokyo, which is a conservative government, on one hand, they've embraced the Trump administration. Prime Minister Abe has met with the president twice, including down in Florida. He's very supportive of the president, and I think that for the Japanese, it's extremely important to maintain a close security relationship with the United States. They're totally dependent on us in that sense. So they're lining up behind whatever it is the United States wants to do, including we have reports that they're ready to dispatch naval vessels to join the carrier battle group that's steaming up towards the Korean Peninsula. And in that sense, they're being very supportive allies. But it's a little bit tricky because South Koreans are still quite nervous about Japan playing a military role. It has all the echoes of the past for South Koreans, reasonable or unreasonable. That's the way they see things. And so they won't necessarily be very happy about the idea of Japanese military deployments at a time like this. But again, it's a kind of a tricky situation. I think Japanese, while they are very supportive of the U.S. being assertive and being deploying forces, at least in a signaling sense, I don't think they're any more interested in a escalation of military conflict on the Korean Peninsula than South Koreans are, because they know that if that gets out of hand, Japan itself is going to be the target, very likely, maybe even more so than we would see in the case of South Korea, because the U.S. bases in Japan are really in some sense, the most vital strategic target for the North Koreans. And they've, in fact, said very clearly that they're testing their missile systems with that target in mind. So I think Japanese are no less worried than South Koreans are about any move that would send this in a military direction.
Let's talk about China a little bit. I mean, President Trump has said that if China doesn't fix North Korea, then we will do it alone. We don't know quite what he has in mind there, but perhaps we can ask you to consider what the implications might be, and what are the constraints and opportunities for China.
Yeah, so I was puzzled by the tweet, and there are many ways to slice and dice this thing. But let me just sort of say that there is a myth out there that I think the president is propagating that China can solve this problem on its own. It can't, and it won't. And that's about as plain as I can say it. It won't, because it's not right now in their interest to see North Korea collapse. It cannot force North Korea to give up its nuclear weapons unless there's some kind of regime change. And China does not want to have a regime change. It wants the status quo, because until larger issues related to the United States are solved, in other words, what is the future of the Korean Peninsula once it's unified, or if the North Korean government collapses, unless there's some decision or agreement of what's going to happen, they're afraid that the U.S. troops are actually going to go right along the Yalu River, have the capability of doing that, which is what they fought the Korean War for, to prevent that from happening. There are larger strategic issues that are much bigger for the Chinese, and so having North Korea and the status quo is very much to their advantage. Now, my argument is that they can't, just in the same reason that if they could have solved this, they would have. Because North Korea, there's no love lost between the Chinese and the North Koreans. They do not like each other. It is a marriage of convenience and interests. And so what has happened over the last several years, if the problem had been, it would have been solved. But the other piece of this is that China has just actually given up a huge amount of leverage. They said that they were going to cut off all imports of coal, which is something they were reluctant to do. We're talking about somewhere, depending on the numbers, you're talking about 50% of their North Korean foreign exchange. Now, normally the Chinese, what they would do is do it in slight tranches, just to give the North Koreans a hint to maintain a certain amount of leverage. In one decision, boom, it's all done. And so they've given up a huge amount of leverage, and what did the North Koreans do? They shot off a missile. Right, and they threaten to do more of that. So so the basic formula that if you're going to get any kind of resolution here is it's going to require definitely more Chinese sticks, harsher sticks, but those alone aren't going to do it, because then it will require on the other side what I call much more sweeter carrots by the United States, Japan, and South Korea. Those together are the only things that are going to get North Korea to decide on its own that it's willing, at least in the short term, and this is what we were trying, what we should be trying to do, is to get a freeze. No more nuclear weapon testing, no more sophisticated nuclear weapons, and no better missiles, I guess is the best way I would describe it, and not selling the stuff. But a combination of carrots and sticks are what's going to happen, and right now we've been all focusing on the sticks.
Dan, do you want to add a few thoughts about China's perspective?
Well, you know, the Chinese, my experience, and Philip has, I think, very similar experiences of talking to Chinese policymakers who deal with North Korea, is they, on one hand, they will complain bitterly about the North Koreans and how ungrateful they are and how difficult they are to deal with, and the client state from hell, as far as they're concerned. On the other hand, if you then say, okay, well, let's have a serious conversation about what we can do to basically change the regime in the North, and which is the only, in my view, the only actual pathway to solving the nuclear problem ultimately, then they'll back off immediately, because they don't want to have that conversation. It opens, as Philip said, a really big Pandora's box for them, which is what is going to be the nature of a unified Korea. I think they prefer to have that buffer state there, up to the point where the one thing that draws the Chinese to act is the fear of conflict. So I believe that in 2003, when the Chinese actually organized at first the four-party talks, which led to the six-party talks, which were the platform for negotiation with North Korea, that was largely prompted by the invasion of Iraq and the Chinese fear that the Bush administration was capable of doing something similar, or at least potentially provoking war on the Korean Peninsula. That certainly moves the Chinese to action, not to overthrow Pyongyang, but at least to try and get things back to a place where they can lower tensions. And I, in some sense, we're playing that game right now, although we're doing it in a rather crude way, if you don't mind me saying. The problem with threatening in an abstract way, as the president has done, well, if you don't do something, you, China, don't do something, we're going to do something on our own. But Chinese have, they've seen this, game played out many, many times. That's not a very credible threat, because they know that not only the South Koreans don't want to go down that road, but actually the U.S. military doesn't want to go down that road. I mean, I have been to Korea for many decades now. I mean, more than 30 years I've been going back and forth to Korea, and I've been meeting with people in the U.S. military there almost every time I go, and I was there for many years as a reporter. The most cautious people I know are the U.S. military commanders there. They're very, very wary of anything that can trigger a sort of spiral of escalation. The Chinese know that too. So you can't make a threat of the use of force unless it's credible. So I don't know that, but I do think it's the sort of element of unpredictability is certainly there with Trump, enough that I think, Xi Jinping, got a little bit worried by, these random tweets that are out there. And I think the Chinese are going to do what they can do to lower tensions, but they are not going to solve the problem for us. And I think that means that we have to go back to the drawing table and think seriously about what diplomacy can possibly achieve in this situation. And I haven't seen the evidence yet that someone is doing that in Washington. I'd be very, very happy to see that evidence.
So stepping back, here are kind of the options that are available to us. I think that, so one is if we use we use pressure and we use sanctions. Well, we've seen where that has got us. It hasn't gotten us very far. At some point, if we continue with the lack of coordination between the United States and China in particular, North Korea will continue as it is, and by calculations, the next 5 years, they will have probably 50 nuclear weapons worth of material and probably a delivery of device, not necessarily hitting the continental United States, but at some point hitting U.S. assets, but definitely all of Japan, all of Korea. So that's where sanctions is going to take us, all right? Now, we already talked about a preemptive attack or an actual, forcing North Korea by force, use of force. You're going to get something people have calculated, and again, forgive me for being so abstract about it, 80,000, 230,000 casualties in Seoul within minutes. I mean, that is absolutely unacceptable. Now, so everyone, if they're putting their focus on the sanctions, this is something that some people are not really thinking about either. What if sanctions really work? Have people thought about that? If sanctions really work, the options, or what happens is what I'm very afraid of. The options are this. If sanctions really work and North Korea and the people there are under desperate circumstances, you're creating a greater incentive for them to sell the stuff. So you've got not one or two nuclear weapons worth of material, but you've got 50 nuclear weapons of material all over the country. Now, what happens if I'm a military person who's in charge of this stuff, and someone comes up to me, and we know people were willing to do this, will offer me $2, $3, $4, $5 million for something the size of a grapefruit, plutonium. Am I going to sell that? I think there's a huge incentive for me to do that if I want to do that. Now, just think about that multiplied by 50 times or 100. Now, let's say sanctions work where you have actually a regime change possibility, or the regime starts to falter and fall apart. Now what you have is nobody in control of that material, and you have what's called a loose nuke situation where that material is gone. Now, I guarantee you, once that piece of material gets out of the United States, out of North Korea, that will blow up either the United States, Europe, or Israel. One of those three places, that's where it's going to happen. So if sanctions is out, if attack is out, if saying to North Korea, you can do all you want, or take over South Korea, that where you completely capitulate and surrender, the only option you have is to actually talk and to use whatever leverage you have to try to get some kind of agreement to roll it back at some point, to stop it, and then later on to roll it back.
Now, to go back to your responses on China, and here, something came to mind from our own presidential campaign. It was interesting how at the end of almost every rally that President Trump, then candidate Trump, held, oddly enough, he would play the song from the Rolling Stones, "You Can't Always Get What You Want." And when I think about China's desire for stability, maybe they can't always get what they want, because we have a president in Washington who is unpredictable, and he's, as he sees it, a disruptor and someone who wants to upend not just domestic policy, but foreign policy. Now, we have seen reversals in recent days, and we may continue to see that. However, it's hard to predict those reversals, just as it's hard to predict the outcome of his claims and his assertions with respect to what he might do. So from China's perspective, I wonder whether they're facing, I have a colleague at Berkeley, Zachary Shore, who's written a very interesting book called A Sense of the Enemy. And he talks about pattern breaks in how states behave. And I wonder whether or not with the current leader of North Korea, and in China's perspective about North Korea, we have a pattern break, a sudden change in the interpersonal relations and the understanding of the behavior and the expected behavior of Kim Jong-un and whether or not they will perhaps be forced, because of this pattern break in North Korean behavior, to adjust what they're doing as they hope for stability but can't really expect to maintain it.
One thing to understand is that the North Korean and Chinese relationship is a long one. After all, Chinese troops intervened in the Korean War, more than millions of them. This is a deep historical relationship that's there, but it's also changed over time. And there clearly is already a break between the Kim Il-sung and then his son Kim Jong-il and now the grandson Kim Jong-un eras. And where this is the first leader of North Korea that has never been to China, and the Chinese, I think, have tried, at times wanted him to come, and at times they don't want him to come. It's a much more visibly tense relationship. There are lots of reports that Xi Jinping personally dislikes Kim Jong-un, and it's a mutual thing. It seems possible, if not likely, that the assassination of Kim Jong-un's half-brother, Kim Jong-nam, that took place in Malaysia, a very bizarre incident, was in some ways based upon the fear that the Chinese, because he's been living basically in exile in China, that the Chinese had sort of had him on ice as a possible successor should they attempt or need to try and overthrow Kim Jong-un. So this is a pretty tense relationship already. And previously, Kim Jong-un had brutally assassinated his uncle, who was always seen as kind of an avenue of Chinese, in fact, described almost explicitly in North Korean media as a agent of Chinese influence in North Korea. So we already got a pretty tense relationship. So that's important because it gives us, some room to maneuver, not a lot. I mean, we're still within the limits of what we know the Chinese are still willing to do. That is, they're not willing to actively destabilize the situation in North Korea. But I think we need to have those conversations with the Chinese, and we've been trying to have those conversations for a long time about what's the future. I truly believe that the other element, which in some ways seems contradictory, is that North Korea is a society in the midst of a lot of change. There is a lot of marketization that's going on. The command economy in North Korea basically collapsed. There's a huge flow of goods going back and forth and people going back and forth into China and ideas that come with that, flow of information, what's going on inside North Korea. We don't entirely know, but we know that North Korean population knows a lot more about the realities of the world. So there's a process of change there. I personally have less confidence in the idea of renegotiating a freeze agreement with North Korea, because frankly, I think the cow left the barn a long, long time ago on that. It's very hard to reconstruct a freeze agreement that's implementable and verifiable. But I do think that we have the option, we have the possibility of encouraging internal change in North Korea, maybe not necessarily in a frontal confrontation fashion, but in a more sort of quiet, subversive fashion. And that, we and the Chinese actually have shared interests. So it's time to have some sophisticated conversations about getting out of the cul-de-sac that we're in.
But that's what the Chinese have been talking about all along. They've been talking about that North Korea can't remain the same. Status quo is not sustainable, so it will have to change. So they want to be able to try to do that and shape that. The Chinese, they're going through their own changes in that way, and one of the things is that there's a severe internal debate as to whether to, there's some people, younger folks that want to have nothing to do with North Korea, and yet right now they still maintain this relationship with North Korea. And the way it has been described to me as terms of their general policy is that the Chinese individual who I respect and take credence in what he says. The general policy is we're not going to let the North Koreans starve, but we're not going to feed them white rice either. So that seems to me sort of what their general sort of approach is at this particular time. And so that's sort of what we're left with.
You're listening to World Affairs, the weekly broadcast of the World Affairs Council. I'm Jane Wales, CEO. We're hearing from Daniel Snyder, Associate Director at Stanford University's Asia-Pacific Research Center. He's in conversation with Philip Yuen, Executive Director at the Plowshares Fund. The event was recorded in San Francisco before a World Affairs audience. Ours is a membership organization. You can reach us at worldaffairs.org. And now back to our moderator, Neil Jock.
During this first half hour, we've been taking questions from the floor, and there are a whole range of very good questions. We'd like to now involve you by way of these questions. Let me begin with this. What role does Russia play today in supporting North Korea, both in military, political, and economic terms? And are they playing a background role, or are they involved in some ways that might prove to be useful?
Well, I was fairly recently in Vladivostok, in the Russian Far East, and I've had a lot of contact there and over the years with Russian North Koreanists, who, by the way, are even more brutal in their commentary on North Korea than the Chinese are. I think the Russians are a minor player. There's a certain amount of cross-border activity and trade that's going on, but not nearly at the scale that we see with China. The Russians would like to be. They've been a participant in the six-party talks, and they'd like to be considered to be a ongoing player in this. But I don't think they have the kind of influence in Pyongyang that the Chinese do. But I think they're important to be rolled into whatever path we go down. And I saw that Secretary Tillerson had conversation in Moscow today with President Putin and with Secretary Lavrov about North Korea, and that's a good thing as far as I'm concerned.
So let me just highlight what Dan said. The way I describe when people ask me about Russia, and this is completely in agreement with Dan, is I kind of look at their role in the Korean Peninsula now as Phantom of the Opera. They're like not around, but they can really mess things up if they want to and throw you a curve. And so the way I look at them is that they just recently made a statement, I believe it was, that I was very surprised, which was something to the effect that if there is a unilateral attack of some kind by the United States, that the Russians would no longer support security, UN security resolutions against North Korea. So they were actually starting to back off on some of this stuff. And Dan has some background in this as well. In terms of the reporting of the relationship with Russia and North Korea in different contexts, but there's a legacy here for Russians. The missile technology, the engines, all of this, I believe, are sourced from Russia. That's my understanding.
Not because the Russians wanted to provide it, but because the North Koreans stole it.
Stole it, right. But there were channels here that were created based on not necessarily Russian government complicity, but relationships with Russia and people there.
Philip, I wonder if we can ask you to expand a little bit about that the technology side of not just what's been transferred from Russia, but what's your assessment of the THAAD system? There's some interest among the audience in some of the more technical elements here, especially in this context, if the North Koreans were to launch that hasn't been in place yet. Mm-hmm. But what's your sense for the technical dynamics?
So the THAAD system is composed of a missile, a panel, control panel, and a radar. And the way I describe it is the idea is to hit a supersonic bullet with another supersonic bullet. It's really technically very difficult to do.
I'm sorry to interrupt, but again, THAAD is for theater high altitude air defense.
So the idea is when a missile goes up, you'll be able to, with calculations, you're able to hit this thing. It is technically very difficult to do. And part of what and this is going to be moved into South Korea. The South Koreans have agreed this in the next couple of years. But it's not at all clear that it's going to work. But it is a political aspect of this in assurances. So if you recall, there was a set of missile tests that happened back in February, a series of four of them that were in a row. That was a clear indicator, a demonstration by the North Koreans saying that any kind of missile defense that you have, we're going to be able to overwhelm. So there have been some successes where it's a one-on-one thing. But what happens is, if you shoot this thing with five or six of these, something is going to be able to get in. The other notion is what we call countermeasures. It's the idea that the missile shoots, and the North Koreans have this capability where when they shoot a missile, it throws off these little sheets of metal that distracts the radar or makes the bullet go after that particular thing and lets the missile go through. So it's a long way of saying, and then the missiles that were just shot were also have the capability, there's a submarine variant. It's a solid fuel missile variant. Now, from my understanding, and I won't go into all the technical details, but if a submarine shoots one of these things, it's going to be too low. The missile shooting it is going to be way too low for THAAD to have any effect at all. So it's a great idea. It's something that should be pursued because it's technology that could protect us. But whether it's going to, in fact, do that, and you can count on that, is something that I don't have necessarily a lot of faith in.
Staying with the technical side of things just for a minute, there was a question about cyber issues. And given North Korea's hacking of Sony some years ago, apparently in response to a movie that Sony had produced, would either of you speculate about what role cyber might be playing on the North Korean side with respect to trying to deny us access? And
There's been reporting on the other side. The New York Times had a long piece recently indicating that the Obama administration had engaged in using cyber weapons to perhaps interrupt the command and control systems of the North Koreans, and that was the responsible for a lot of failed tests, particularly of their medium-range missile system. I don't know. I have no independent way of knowing whether that's the case or not. North Korean missile tests have failed quite a lot, but then I am also aware that in the history of our missile program in the early years, there were lots of failures as well. So whether we can attribute that to cyber warfare or not, I don't know. The North Korean cyber warfare has been very effective at hacking into large computer systems. They've done it with South Korean banks. You mentioned the Sony case. There's a lot of cyber espionage going on into South Korea and probably into the U.S. as well. The problem with doing it the other way is that the North Korean internet system is an intranet. It's not. It's sealed off from the global internet system. A little harder to penetrate, not impossible, there's definitely a lot of cyber warfare going on, but whether it can affect, you know, the potential to defend, for example, against a missile attack, I don't think so. Really.
So part of the thing that we have to realize is that part of the danger of going into cyber war or legitimizing it, and it may happen anyway, is that we're much more vulnerable to cyber attack than North Korea is. And you can guarantee that they've got a lot of people who are working on that in North Korea that are trying to figure out ways to make our life absolutely miserable if they have to. That I can't say as a fact that I know that, but that's just my instinct that is what's happening right now. You've got probably people in Pyongyang or other places who spend most of their days trying to figure out how to make Americans or the US military or whoever their life miserable. And cyber is definitely going to be one tool in which they have the capability of doing and that they will exploit. Now, what we're spending a lot of time in the United States is trying to harden and trying to prevent those attacks. And you read a lot of descriptions as to, you know, how we're doing that because we are quite vulnerable.
We've been taking a relatively high-level view of things, and one of the questions points toward a very much more human, individual-level problem on the peninsula, and that's the reunification and the family communications and visits. I wonder if you have any thoughts about not necessarily how this reunification and communication issue affects the current crisis, but what the dynamics are with respect to North and South under the new regime. Is that something that's going to be a card that the North plays? Is it something that the South will be vulnerable to if they come in with a new sunshine policy orientation? What are your thoughts?
All Koreans, North and South, share the dream of reunification. You know, divided Korea is a creation of the Korean War. There's no historical North Korea, no historical South Korea. And I personally feel very strongly about that as well. This is a country that should be reunified peacefully. But South Koreans will tell you also that they see this as something very distant, something off in the future. And they certainly don't want it to happen forcefully. But those feelings, those emotions, those desires for unification are always there, and they can be played upon. And I think that what we will see with the next South Korean government, and this is could be an important factor in terms of the issues we've been talking about earlier, is, again, a resumption of the large-scale, particularly economic and social and cultural, and that includes family reunification gatherings, engagement policy. And that could relieve some pressure on the North Korean government economically, because before, 10 years ago, when the progressives were in power in South Korea, there was a very large-scale flow of resources in terms of food aid, in terms of trade, from south to north. And, you know, this huge dependency on China that we see now by North Korea, 90% dependency, that is a product of the basic shutdown of, to a large extent, of all the economic activity. And that included this industrial park that was located in Kaesong inside North Korea, where 50,000 North Korean workers were working in South Korean-run factories. I think we could see a movement back towards that because the progressives believe that they, first of all, they're terrified of the rise of tensions. They believe that it's necessary to lower tensions, and the way to do that is to resume that kind of North-South engagement, not at the cost of the alliance with the U.S., but I think they want to go down that road. And that can change the dynamic, although in some ways for North Korea, for the regime, it's easier, it's better, almost preferable to have a conservative government in power in the South, because then you have the enemy that you can point to. So it's a complicated situation.
So I think that the North will try to use it to their advantage, but I also think that it can be used to our advantage in many different ways. And part of what I would have to say is there's a tendency among policy people and folks in Washington to look at North Korea and the Korean Peninsula as a problem to be solved. It's an abstraction. And so one of the things that I think family, the unification, the human rights aspect, is the notion that what's happening or what could happen in North Korea is going in North Korea and in South Korea and the Korean Peninsula as a whole happen to people, real people. They happen to people that I know, you know, my relatives. I have a number of relatives who are there in South Korea. My mom is from what is now North Korea, and my father is from what is South Korea. These are real people. Their lives are going to be affected by these decisions, and I think it's really important that we make sure that all these decisions are not abstract but are grounded in our own humanity. And so I think that the family unification is probably the focal point of what this can be and should be about, and maybe it will help to change people's perceptions and help them try to find a different paradigm, which is what is sorely needed now with respect to the Korean Peninsula.
Mm-hmm. I think that we started by talking about and looking at the military confrontation, and I quoted Phillips' reference to a metal-on-metal collision, but I think among the audience questions, there's some interest in, can we talk a little bit more about the diplomatic side? So there are a couple of questions that are I'll just relate to both of you. One is, what concessions will the U.S. have to make to get North Korea to stop developing ICBMs and smaller bombs? And then the second related is, if diplomacy is the best option for the United States, what is North Korean leadership's incentive to engage? Any thoughts on those two elements?
So in certain sense, there is rocket science and nuclear science involved in this, but in terms of the basic formula with respect to North Korea and a diplomatic solution, it's relatively basic, but the devil is in the details. So essentially what we want is we want North Korea to stop producing nuclear material and making better, more effective nuclear bombs, essentially miniaturization, making it small enough to mount on a nuclear device. The second thing we want is to stop them to do missile development. And the third is we want them not to sell this stuff or their technology. North Korea and why they are doing this, and I can explain this later, but I believe that their ultimate focus, their ultimate goal is regime change. And in order to accomplish those things, they look to nuclear weapons because it accomplishes three things.
One, regime security.
Regime security, right. Regime survival. Thank you. And the reason they want nuclear weapons is because the three things to ensure regime survival for them and is that they are protect North Korea from attack and intimidation. They are, they join the big boys club and have some kind of political legitimacy, and people take them seriously. And third, there's this thing about economic development. And what I mean by that is that there's precedents where if you have security, the United States provided security for East Asia. And so therefore, the United States said to South Korea, Japan, Philippines, you spend all of your money on developing the economy, we'll protect you. China did a very similar thing in the late 1970s and early 80s. They had enough, they had nuclear weapons, they had a military, they focused on military, on economic development. So the North Koreans look at nuclear weapons as that. So what we have to do then is give those three things. Provide for their security and saying that we won't, you will, you know, that you will be prevented from, you're safe from invasion and intimidation. The second thing is we will give you some kind of political legitimacy, and the third is we'll give you economic benefits. That's the formula.
So my contrarian voice is there's nothing we can provide the North Koreans that will substitute from the point of view of their need for regime security for the effect of having nuclear weapons. They're never going to give them up. I don't believe it. I'm not interested myself in renegotiating a freeze because the problem is, you know, once they crossed the line and started developing nuclear weapons, before they had the weapons,
right. You
could freeze. Once they have the weapons, you end up basically certifying them as a nuclear weapon state, and we really can't afford to do that without, in fact, opening the door to South Korea and potentially Japan going nuclear. So my approach is this. Let's try and encourage the forces of change within within North Korea, and let's offer them what we've offered them in the past, the not an incremental agreement, but the end point, which they claim that they want, which is full-scale recognition, a peace treaty, and the all of the guarantees of non-hostility, the so-called grand bargain. Let's and a one-to-one meeting between our president and theirs, because that's something they've always sought. Let's put that all on the table, but it can only go on the table if you give up in a verifiable way your nuclear weapons. I don't think we're going to get that, but I think we need to put that package on the table, not the least of which is we need to reassure the South Koreans that we're going to do everything possible to seek a peaceful solution to this problem.
So Dan and I are not really in that much disagreement. I think that the chances of a freeze right now in this circumstance is very, very small. But in this political environment that I think is here in the United States and elsewhere, that's all the traffic is going to be able to bear. And I think taking that big step forward is going to be very difficult to do. So at least do no harm, and let's try to see if we can do that. Because my view, and I agree with Dan in the sense that North Korea is not going to give these up. They really won't. What I think their end game is this. I think they have a number in mind. They want to have, at some point in the next 10 years or wherever, they want to have X number of nuclear weapons, and they want to have a delivery system. That's what they're shooting for. And everything that I've seen over the last 10 to 15 years, they've been going on parallel tracks, and the diplomacy side hasn't worked, so they've been continuing on this track of getting that. Once they have that, then what they're going to do is they're going to go to the United States and the international community and say, okay, we have these weapons. You haven't been able to. We're ready to talk now. So let's talk arms control. If we give up 25, half of these, what are you going to give us in return? And by doing that, they ensure their security. They get recognition of these things, and they become part of the international community because their weapons are legitimized. So this is where they're ending up. And what I'm trying to do is short circuits that before we get to that particular point. So he and I are not really disagreeing. It's just that, you know, I think that it's worthwhile at this point to try the diplomatic piece to see if we can do this. Otherwise, we're going to be faced with that other choice. And getting there poses problems because, how can I say this? I used to work in Silicon Valley, and people talked about a number in mind, right? They had a number of how much, how much money they wanted to make, or what kind of technology they wanted to be able to do, or how they wanted. But what I found really interesting that people's number always changed. You know, once they got to the place, they realized, well, it wasn't quite what they expected it was going to be. So this is the phenomena, I think, with respect to North Korea. Even though they say we want 50 or 35 or whatever, once they get there, they may say it's not enough. And they may say, well, you know, we actually have a significant power, so maybe we can use this to intimidate people in a way that we had not even thought about. So these are the dangers that you have to getting to that particular place.
There are a couple of questions about regime change and unification. And it leads to one thought, which is that there is a deal on the table that's possible, but it would be without the U.S. involved. And that would be something along the following lines, that the Chinese approach the South Koreans and say unification is inevitable. We will put pressure on North Korea to eliminate the regime. We will help to unify North and South under a South Korean model. So following a little bit the German reunification model, you folks in Seoul will have to pay for it, but we'll put the necessary pressure on the North to bring it down, to make it part of a unified South Korean model country. And the price tag is there are no U.S. uniforms on the peninsula as a consequence. Any thoughts about something like that, whether that has potential?
Well, that may be the end point anyway of a unified Korea. I mean, I wouldn't, if that's the conversation the Chinese want to initiate, I'd be happy to see that take place. I mean, you know, if we have a unified Korea without nuclear weapons, it's a legitimate question whether we need to have U.S. troops there. I think the goal here is to, make sure that we avoid war, a war that would be of disastrous consequences for many, many people, not just the Koreans. And that's the sort of immediate thing facing us right now. And anything that gets us at least closer to that, to me, is a good thing. Without, of course, undermining our security and without undermining our alliance with South Korea. I always worry about any deal done at the expense of the people with whom, after all, we shed blood together to defend their freedom. And that I never forget.
So really quickly, to have any diplomatic solution, I think, on the Korean Peninsula is going to require the United States, South Korea, China, Japan, but mainly China, the United States, South Korea, to agree on a strategy vis-a-vis North Korea. And that is going to require a discussion about the future of the Korean Peninsula. That is one scenario, for sure. But there are a lot of other scenarios. And up to now, as Dan has very much correctly pointed out to, having that discussion, the Chinese and others have loathed to have that conversation. If you can't have that conversation, then it's going to be very difficult to figure out a way to get everybody to be on the same page and work together. So that's how I would answer that question. It's certainly a possibility.
Well, thank you both for your thoughts. Please join me in thanking these two astute scholars.
You've been listening to World Affairs, the weekly broadcast of the World Affairs Council. Ours is a membership organization, and we're dedicated to engaging the public in conversations that matter. You can visit us at worldaffairs.org. This week's program featured Daniel Snyder, Associate Director at Stanford University's Asia-Pacific Research Center, Philip Yuen, Executive Director of the Plowshares Fund, and they were in conversation with Neil Jock of the University of California, Berkeley. This broadcast is made possible weekly by the generous support of Chevron. Our recording engineer is Jim Bennett. Our technical supervisor is Monte Carlos. World Affairs is produced in association with KQED Radio. I'm Jane Wales. Thank you for joining us.